Before you get started with this edition of the Books podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
People do change. History is filled with people who change their minds and hearts in a small way. This is my political credo, and this is also my business as a novelist. If you wish, this novel, every one of my novel, is about a relatively non-dramatic changes which do occur in the hearts and minds of people. You want me to know if and when this will happen in the Middle East? I'm sorry, I don't know.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. I'm Claire Armitstead. This week, we feature a Guardian Live interview with the acclaimed Israeli novelist and essayist Amos Oz. His attitude to his own nationality makes it astonishingly difficult to separate the political from the poetic in Oz's work, and no more so than in his latest novel, Judas. This is a story set in Jerusalem in the winter of 1959-60. It tells of three people: Shmuel Ash, a young idealist who answers a job advert and ends up as a companion to an elderly intellectual, Gershom Valt, in Jerusalem, and Valt's daughter-in-law, Atalia, by whom Shmuel becomes bewitched. As ever with Oz's writing, it's filled with thought and argument and ideas, in this instance with hugely politicised perspectives on Judas, Jesus and Christianity itself. He is not a man to shy from provocation. As he says himself,
"My business in life is the road not taken."
So let's hear him navigate that road in the capable hands of The Guardian's own Jonathan Friedland, who begins by taking us down memory lane.
You and I have spoken at intervals when new books of yours have come out for many, many years. It will date both of us if I reveal that our first interview was when I was 18 in 1985, and you were younger then than I am now. So we've grown old together in a way. And then you said at one point, I was talking about Israel and how it was viewed, and you said, "I have news for your listeners." It was a radio interview. You said, "Israel is not a Christian country." And you explained how people misunderstand Israel. And yet you are very interested in, you were then, and you've written about it in other novels, in Christianity. So tell this audience what it is about that that draws you, and what it is that drew you eventually to tell this story, which partly is animated by this figure of Judas.
Well, shalom to all of you. Shalom, Jonathan. It's nice to be dancing with you yet again. Essentially, this book is about three people. There is an aging intellectual, there is a middle-aged, angry and attractive woman, and young idealistic student. They sit together in the same room for the whole winter. They drink gallons of tea and they talk. This is not the beginning of a joke. This is my novel. Judas is in the background. Christianity is in the background. The book is not an essay, and it's not meant to be an essay. Yes, they have ideas, my characters. Everyone has ideas. The uneasy relationship between Jews and Christians, between Judaism and Christianity. They talk about Arabs and Palestinians as well. Don't worry, this is coming. In your next question, I presume. So they talk about everything, from sex to money. I became intrigued, fascinated with the New Testament when I was a 16-year-old schoolboy in Kibbutz Hulda. You know, they don't teach the New Testament in Jewish school anywhere, alas. I realized at the age of 16 that unless I read the Gospels, I will never have access to Renaissance art or to the music of Bach or to the novels of Dostoevsky. So in the evenings, when the other boys went to play basketball or to chase the girls, I had no chance in either, so I found my comfort in Jesus. I went alone to the library, I read the New Testament. I was enchanted, I still am enchanted with the figure of Jesus, his poetry, his humor, his compassion, his warmth, his simplicity. Although he and I disagree on many things, like any two Israelis. You never get even one of us to agree with himself or herself because everybody has a divided mind and soul. For instance, Jesus says that, "Forgive them because they know not what they are doing." I can live with the first half of these sentences. We ought to forgive from time to time. But they know not what they are doing. Are we all moral imbeciles? Don't we know that we are inflicting pain on others when we inflict pain on others? Oh, I disagree. We know. We still do it from time to time, but we know. So we may disagree, Jesus and I, but there is a deep love in me for this wonderful Jew, I think one of the greatest Jews who ever lived. And yes, he was born a Jew, he died like a Jew, it never occurred to him to establish a new religion. He never crossed himself, not once, he had no reason to. He never set foot in a synagogue, in a church, there were no churches. He went to synagogue very often to create scandals. However, when in my reading I reached the story about Judas, the 30 pieces of silver, the most famous kiss in history, more famous than Romeo and Juliet, I was enraged, not as a Jew, not for theological reasons. The little detective in me rebelled against this story. It was an unacceptable story, illogical story. It was also a very badly written story, which any good editor should have edited out of the Gospels. I asked myself, how much money are the most famous 30 pieces of silver? We had no Google at that time, but it was easy to find it out in books. It's the equivalent of about £400. It's a handsome sum of money, but for a wealthy man, and Judas was not one of those poor fishermen from Galilee like the other apostles, he was a wealthy man. This is not a fortune. Why would he sell his master, his teacher, his God for £400 and then almost immediately go hang himself? And suppose he did, why should anyone pay Judas even a sixpence to identify Jesus to those who came to arrest him? Jesus was known all over town. Everybody knew him. He preached everywhere. He created a scandal at the temple. And when they came to arrest him, he did not shave his beard. He was not wearing a sombrero. And he never said, I'm not Jesus, I'm Donald Trump. Why the kiss? Why the kiss? Why the payment? Why the betrayal? This infuriated me. And this is not an innocent story. I think this story is responsible, more than any other story ever told in history, responsible for rivers of blood, for generations of hatred and persecution and inquisition and massacres and possibly the Holocaust. There is a stereotype of the Jew in populistic Christian imagination as Judas. In many dictionaries, it's even difficult to distinguish between the two. German, Jude, Judas. How can you expect a three-year-old child hearing the story for the first time to make the distinction? Or in Spanish, Judas, Judios. It's the same word. So yes, it irritated me, it infuriated me, and I thought this story is the Chernobyl of world antisemitism. And it kept me busy for many years. Finally, not me, but my protagonist, Shmuel Ash, he proposed a very different story. In fact, he proposes a story which is meant to neutralize the lethal radiation of this Chernobyl of antisemitism. He tells the story about betrayal and loyalty in a totally different way.
We should come to that, but just before we get to this very fresh view of the Judas story which your character Shmuel offers, your people will be interested in, I think, this 16-year-old Amos, yes, on the kibbutz in the library when everyone else is playing basketball and you're immersing yourself in the Jesus story. Firstly, there's a personal element here, or rather a family connection.
Yeah.
And one of your characters picks up a book by a Klausner, mm-hmm, and people who follow you know, yeah, that was the name you were born with. Just tell us about that family connection. But also then go on to say, you said you really loved him, the Jesus character. You loved him, you think he's one of the greatest Jews. I just wonder if you were ever tempted then, as a young man or later on in life, to go further with this and be a believer.
How can I be a believer when I don't even share the sweet but immature idea of universal love? Jesus' prime idea that it is possible for every one of us to love everyone else. I wish it would have been true, but I know better than that, and even at the age of 16 I knew better than that, because the boys were successful with the girls and I was not. So universal love was not part of my experience.
And tell us about the Klausner,
yes,
in the book.
Yes, my great uncle Joseph Klausner wrote a book, which 90 years ago when it was published, was extremely controversial both about among Jews and among Christians. He suggested, based on deep scholarly research, that Jesus was born a Jew, died a Jew, and if anything, he was, I won't call him a reformist Jew, more like a fundamentalist Jew, but not in the bad sense of the word fundamentalism, not in the fanatic sense. He wanted to remove layers of fat, which he thought are making Judaism far removed from its origins. He wanted to bring the Jewish faith, the Jewish morality, back to its desert origins, lean, sparse, direct, and extremely democratic. Joseph Klausner wrote about it. Christians didn't like it because he was Judaizing the Messiah. And Jews didn't like it because he was pardoning someone who became a symbol of our persecutors. I learned from him the bit about Jesus. He never wrote about Judas. No Jew that I know of, except in very modern time, for generations, no Jew ever mentioned Judas. It's an interesting case. I think Jewish scholars, writers, poets in thousands of years were too embarrassed and perhaps too terrified to even mention him. It's like you had some relative spending life sentence for multiple rape in jail. You don't talk about this person. Jews were embarrassed. Shmuel Ash, my protagonist, he is the one who decides to reopen the whole case, to retell the story of Judas. Now, is his version of the story true or not? I don't know. He suggests that Judas believed in Jesus even more than Jesus ever believed in himself. He is the one, according to Shmuel Ash, Judas is the one who persuaded Jesus to go to Jerusalem, get crucified, walk off the cross, and convert the whole world. If he walks alive off the cross, the whole world will convert right away. This will be the beginning of the kingdom of heaven right away. And performing miracles in remote provincial parts of Galilee, he could do this for 1,000 years, it's not going to change the world. Judas was a man of the world, according to this version. He said, you have to come to Jerusalem, and you have to get crucified prime time on television when the whole world is watching. And you will walk off the cross, and you will say, love one another, and that will be it. After that, there will be no need for further miracles by anyone. Jesus is hesitant. This is not Shmuel Ash. This is in the Gospels. He's afraid of death, like you and me. He doesn't really want to go to Jerusalem. He is not at all sure that he can perform the miracle. And Judas says, come on, this is peanuts for you. You have resurrected the dead. You have walked on the water. You will show them. Your father will help you. Finally, Jesus is persuaded, and Judas has to use some connections in order to get Jesus crucified. Nobody is really interested to crucify him. The priests, well, they have seen all those self-pronounced saviors from Galilee. There are hundreds of them in town. The Romans, they know that all the Jews are obsessed with God. Why crucify this one? So it takes Judas a few telephone calls to influential people to arrange the crucifixion prime time. And Jesus is bleeding on the cross and bleeding on the cross and bleeding on the cross. And the audience is beginning to disperse. This is the eve of the holiday. And Jesus says, well, show them. Do it now. And this Son of Man, he pulls the nails. He tries hard to walk off the cross. And when he fails, he says the most famous words ever said in history. Oh God, why have you forsaken me? Which are the words said by a man who believed or half believed that his father was going to get him off the cross. And when this doesn't happen, he dies a broken man. And Judas goes and hangs himself, asking himself, what have I done?
And in this version, it is Judas who is the true believer. Rather than being a traitor to Jesus, he's the ultimate believer in Jesus.
He is the ultimate believer.
He thought he could pull off this miracle of miracles.
As I said, he believes in Jesus more than Jesus believes in himself. Now, is this the true version? I don't know. On this particular Friday of the crucifixion, I missed it. I had a dentist appointment the same time. But coming to think about it, Shmuel Ash's version sounds to me much more persuasive reasonable, acceptable, than that terrible, unlikely, vicious story in the Gospels.
So given that you do write nonfiction, and given that you have what in Yiddish would be called yichus, you have the family pedigree to write about questions of Jesus because of your great uncle, why didn't you make him write an essay as Amos Oz with this new theory of the Judas story, which is such an arresting and fresh take on the Judas story? And as you say, Judas is absolutely central in the kind of iconography of anti-Semitism. And you talk there, I think, about how in the Last Supper, all the other disciples are these blonde, blue-eyed, Aryan-looking figures. The only one who looks like a Jew, in caricature terms, is Judas. Why haven't you written this as Amos Oz's thesis on Judas, rather than attributing it to your protagonist in fiction?
Well, it came from my protagonist in fiction. Believe it or not, I was thinking about an alternative story, about neutralizing Chernobyl for almost 50 years, before the idea dawned on Shmuel Ash. He came first, long before the idea. You know, I don't know how it is with other novelists, and I cannot speak for other novelists. On a lucky evening, I managed to speak for this one. Characters come first. They bring with them, each one of them, his or her memories, life experience, pains, secrets, desires, a sense of humor or lack of humor, and yes, ideas. It's part of the personality and not the other way around. Shmuel Ash came to me long before he became the bearer of the new gospel. And this is a gospel according to Shmuel Ash. By the way, if I would have written an essay about this, it would probably be less effective than this student, whose subject for his university thesis is Jesus in the eyes of the Jews, or Jewish conceptions of Jesus. And he stumbles over Judas, and he has reasons to identify with Judas. And perhaps you and I talk about those reasons later. It's not by chance that of all the various characters in the novel, Shmuel is the one who is obsessed with treason.
With treachery and treason, it's a very big theme. I was going to get to that. I wonder if now there would be a good moment to hear something of the book, because you've talked about how the characters come first, and it's one of these things that critics often do say about the place or the location is itself a character. Yeah. And often when I read that, I confess I don't quite understand what the critic means. In this book, I really do. You have set it in a wintry Jerusalem in 1959. The important point for people who know Jerusalem is, of course, then it is 7 years before the Six-Day War, and therefore we are talking really about West Jerusalem, separated from Jordanian Jerusalem, as you refer to it here, by barbed wire and no man's land. It's very atmospheric. It's a winter. You'd have been 20 years old. I don't know if you were in Jerusalem then or if you were elsewhere in Israel, but you describe it absolutely as if you were there. It's very atmospheric, and you're going to read for us a bit there where yes. Shmuel Ash, this character, and Atalia, the older woman he's falling for, go for a walk. But perhaps you introduce it.
בוא נלך. הירח יעלה עוד מעט. אני אוהבת לראות איך הוא מגיח מפני
הערים. Come on, let's go. The moon will be up soon. I love to watch it burst out among the hills and soar over the rooftops. They went out of the house into the dark yard, which was in the shadow of the trees, a shadow deepened by the row of cypresses behind the house. Shmuel could barely make out the iron lid of the cistern. Atalia held his elbow and guided him along the path paved with dressed Jerusalem stone. Through the sleeve of his threadbare coat, he could feel the warmth of her hand, each of her fingers, and he longed with all his being to lay his own hand on hers, which was now guiding him on the steps. But he was afraid of her sarcasm. Instead of touching her, he took the inhaler out of his pocket. After one deep breath, he felt better and put the inhaler back in his pocket. Rabbi Elbaz Lane was empty, a street lamp inlaid with little rectangular panels of glass from the time of the British Mandate, waved in the breeze on a cable strung across the line. The lamp cast a ceaseless, restless movement of wave-like shadows onto the paving stones. The westerly breeze was light and silent, as if it had been sent to cool a glass of tea. Shmuel said, "Tell me what sort of man your father was." Atalia replied in a soft voice, almost in a whisper, "Let's not talk now. Let's walk without talking. Let's listen to the sounds of the night." At the end of Rabbi Elbaz Lane, the moon leapt above the tiled roofs, red and huge, like a demented sun, determined to burst forth in the night against every law of nature. Shmuel disliked this moon because it had condemned him to silence. Atalia stopped, her hand still holding his elbow, as if afraid he might stumble, and looked for a long time at the moon or at the ring of brightness that surrounded it, and poured down to whiten the walls of Jerusalem stone with a pallid, skeletal glow. Suddenly she said, "I don't know why we think of the moon as white. It isn't at all white. It's all bloodshot." Then they walked in silence along the narrow streets of the Nachlaot, Atalia leading and Shmuel following half a stride behind. She had let go of his sleeve, but from time to time she touched his shoulder gently to steer him to the left or right. A boy and girl passed them with their arms around each other and walked on up the street. The boy said, "I don't believe it. It just can't be true." The girl replied, "Just wait. You'll see."
Well, before we go on, allow me to express my gratitude and my admiration to my wonderful English translator and in many ways my teacher, Nicolas Delange, whose prose you have just heard.
I agree with that. I join the applause because he is a wonderful translator and has translated almost all of your work into English here. But you just, before we heard that extract, you talked about treason and treachery, and of course Judas is a kind of definitive, you know, it's used even as a synonym for traitor. And there are different characters, several characters in the novel who are carrying some kind of burden of treachery. They've been accused of being a traitor, or a relative close to them has been accused. And particularly, because it gets to some of the politics that's in the book, Atalia, who we heard about just there, her father, who's no longer alive in the book, but sort of is a ghostly presence, mm-hmm. both in the house, where they're all cooped up, but also in the novel, he was accused of a kind of political treachery. And perhaps you should say something about what his political crime was that in 1959 was seen as treason.
Well, yes, two alleged huge traitors in this novel. One is Judas, who is known to all of you. The other one is Shealtiel Abravanel's, Atalia's father. Don't Google him, you won't find him. In the novel, he is a prominent Zionist leader, a member of the Zionist shadow government of the Jewish community in Palestine, who objects the idea of creating a Jewish state as part of the partition plan. He is kicked out of all the Zionist leadership institutions and lives the rest of his life like a hated, boycotted, mad dog alone in his house. Now, Shealtiel is regarded as a traitor not because he was an Arab lover or a self-hating Jew, not even because he preferred a binational solution to a two-state solution, none of that. He was opposed to the very idea of nation-states. He suggested that there is no point in creating a little Jewish anachronistic state at an age when very soon there will be no more states left in the world, there will be no more boundaries, many cultures, many traditions, many civilizations, no states. He believed in the family of people. Now, just like Judas, this he has in common with Judas. He was more loyal than the loyalists, and he was full of love. Was he right or wrong in the eyes of others? Obviously, he was wrong. And the dream of a universal human family is close to Jesus, not to Judas. Spiritually, this Abravanel is very close to Jesus Christ in believing in universal love, the possibility of universal love. He says at some point, I mean, his ghost says it. I said earlier, three people drinking tea and talking. That's not quite fair because in the house there are also a number of ghosts. There is the ghost of Abravanel, the ghost of Judas, the ghost of Jesus, the ghost of the fallen young men who died in the war, and maybe in a strange way, even the ghost of Ben-Gurion, who was then still prime minister and defense minister and father of the nation, but his ghost is also taking part in the debate. When Abravanel says that a world divided into 200 separate states is like a zoo with separate cages, Gershom Wald, old man Gershom Wald, responds, he says, you know, when people do behave like savage beasts, it's not a bad idea to put them in separate cages. And when he preaches, or his ghost preaches, the idea of world without boundaries, old man Wald, and behind him the ghost of Ben-Gurion, responds, it's a wonderful idea, but we Jews have performed such a one-man show for thousands of years. No country, no army, no homeland, no states, no walls. The world audience rarely applauded, more often threw eggs and rotten tomatoes at the actor, and even more often just cut the throat of the actor. So this time, we Jews will have bars on the windows, lock on the door, same as everyone else. When everyone else gives up the walls and the bars and the locks, we will join the party, but we won't be the first ones or the second ones in the neighborhood. We will wait a little bit. We will join the orgy after we are sure that this is a real business and not a dream.
And here in the book, you're quoting and citing Gershom Wald, and we understand that's the character. In that particular case, that is something I've heard you, as Amos Oz, say too, that this idea of living without states, moving to this higher form of civilization, others, I'm happy for others to try that. We will be with pleasure the third or the fifth or the tenth country to try that, but we're not going to be the first because we've already tried that.
You will find a lot of me in each one of those characters, so please don't try to identify me with one of them.
One in particular.
You know, I wrote a piece of chamber music, a trio, maybe a quintet if we count the ghosts. It's a mistake to approach the composer after the concert and ask him or her, do you really identify with the violin or are you rather behind the cello? Yeah. I am everywhere and nowhere. I like them all. I even love them, but I don't identify completely with any one of them.
The character Shmuel says about a people who for thousands of years have known well the power of books and the power of prayer, that only knew the power of power itself in the form of blows on its back, and suddenly it finds itself holding a heavy cudgel, tanks, cannon, jet planes. It's only natural that such a people get drunk on power and tends to believe that it can do whatever it likes by the power of power. And there, I'm reminded of something you, as Amos Oz, have written, which is that part of your worry is that Israel has become a nation that only has one implement in its hand, namely a hammer, and to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. And that Israel has become over-reliant to solve all its problems on force. Again, I'm putting this to you not just because Shmuel says it, but because I've heard you say it.
No, I think Shmuel has a good point here. He has a good point. He takes it too far, but he has a good point. the Jews have not experienced the power of power for thousands of years, and yes, they get carried away. Later on, in the same page which you have quoted from, there is a good answer from Shmuel himself. What are the limits of physical power? What are the things that you cannot do by physical power? And I think that part of his monologue is quite close to my heart. He explains that it is a mistake to think that you can change hearts by force. You can beat your enemies by force, and sometimes you ought to do that. You cannot change hearts by force, and it happens to be Israel's main existential problem. Change the hearts of its neighbors, of its subjects, of its Palestinian partners in the same land or in the neighboring land. You don't change hearts with a big stick. Am I against a big stick? No, I am not. Am I a pacifist European style, make love, not war? No, I am not. Have I been convinced by Jesus Christ that you have to turn your other cheek to your enemy? Certainly not. To many European pacifists, the ultimate evil is violence. Not to me. To me, the violence evil in this world is aggression. Aggression is the mother of all violence, to misquote Saddam Hussein. And aggression sometimes ought to be stopped by force. So aggression, not violence, is my diagnosis of the malaise, the worst malaise in the world. And I had a relative, I think I told you that earlier, I had a relative who survived a Nazi concentration camp. And she kept reminding us younger people that the people who finally liberated her from the Nazi concentration camp, they were not peace demonstrators with placards and olive branches. No, they were soldiers with helmets and submachine guns. I will not forget this lesson. I've been on the battlefield twice in my life. I'm not happy about this. It was one of the worst experiences in my life, but I'm not ashamed of it.
Because you fought in 56 and in 67?
No, in 67 and 73.
67 and
56, I was still in school, reading about Jesus in the library in the evening, and you see, it didn't work well enough for me.
On this point about force, you said you've made a very eloquent case there of how it's necessary, but not sufficient. Mm-hmm. In your view, what is the thing that could change minds of Israel's neighbours? Force won't do it. You just channeled the voice of Shmuel there to say it couldn't do it. What might change minds and hearts?
I answer this question, Jonathan, provided that it's clear to everybody that at this moment we close the book and we talk about my ideas.
We're talking now about your ideas, but okay. We may reopen the book because there's lots in there. But for now, this is about you.
Oh, yeah. We may get back to the book, but you are asking me about my ideas.
Yes.
Well, I have always believed that the only way to change or to repel bad ideas is to come forth with better ideas. The big stick is necessary. Fighting against ISIS, fighting against Islamic fanaticism, the answer has to come from within moderate Islam. Not from me. I don't have the answer. But it has to come as an idea generated from moderate Islam, and it should be a sufficient answer for radical, fanatic, violent Islam. The same applies not just to Islam. It applies to anti-Islamic fanatics, and there are such people here in town. It applies to all forms of fanaticism. You have to come with a better idea. Communism was beaten not just by the big stick or by the Star War. Communism was actually beaten by Truman's Marshall Plan many years before the wall collapsed. He is the one who won the Cold War by marketing successfully a better idea. What turned out to be a better idea. By the way, not a wonderful idea, not a perfect idea, but a better idea. So the way to change hearts or to change minds is to come forth either with seduction or with better ideas, or better still, with a cocktail of seduction and better ideas.
And well, that's appealing. What would be some of those better ideas that might win over those drawn to, as you describe it, fanaticism?
Well, there are better ideas for different kinds of fanatics, and this evening is not going to be a course in comparative fanaticism, much as I dream to teach such a course one day in some college, much as I think that courses in comparative fanaticism ought to be introduced in any classroom, in any college, in any university in our day and age. There is no one answer. And if anyone offers you one answer to all forms of fanaticism, he is or she is a fanatic.
In brackets, we should say that fanaticism is a real motif in your fiction and non-fiction, actually.
Oh, yes. Well, it's
You have at least two in this book, Judas being one of them. Yeah. But it's a real motif. It's a particular... Tell me if I'm wrong, but it's a particular kind of mindset you identify that marks out somebody as a fanatic. And you can find them in any society. Perhaps just say a few lines on you know, it's been there in several novels of yours. What kind
I've
of
been
person
fascinated,
is...
I've been fascinated by a fanatic gene, which I am afraid is present in almost every one of us. It's not overwhelming and dominant in every one of us, but it exists in almost every one of us. It lies in the urge to change other people for their own good, which is a noble motive. A fanatic is a great altruist. He's more interested in you than in himself or herself. He wants to save your soul. He wants to change you. He wants to redeem you. He wants to liberate you from your smoking habits or your voting habits or whatever. If you prove to be irredeemable, he will be at your throat and he will kill you for your own good. But essentially, the fanatic is a walking exclamation mark. And you identify a fanatic by the fact that he or she has a short, smashing answer to everything. The reason why fanaticism, not only in this novel, in our day and age, had become the major danger to all of us. I think the more complex the issues become, the more people crave for very simple one-sentence answers. And this is everywhere and in many, many forms. including some allegedly anti-fanatic forms. Now, I think this is yes, it is one of the issues of this novel, and along with loyalty and treason, love and desire, Christianity and Judaism, Palestinians and Israelis, old age and young age, men and women, this is part of the orchestra of this novel, fanaticism.
I'm aware that people will want to come in with their own questions and thoughts, and we will do that quite soon. There are two areas politically that I thought we might talk about. Let's start with the one that does have a connection to the novel. So Abravanel, who is this ghostly figure, he's dead, but when the story starts, was condemned as a traitor by some in the Zionist establishment. But he was this idealist who thought Jews and Arabs could all get along, maybe not even with a state, let alone a binational state. The position of people like you and others really, and you were very, very early on this, and we should say that next year, of course, is going to be the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War in which you fought. Very early on the seventh day, metaphorically, you and a few others said, we are going to have to share this land. We can't hold on to these conquered territories forever. And there will have to be a two-state solution. And here we are 50 years later, and it still hasn't happened. And people are impatient and beginning to wonder if it will never happen, because now there are so many settlements. The occupation has gone on for five decades. And that whether now people who, in principle, agree with you and agreed with you that the land has to be shared, whether people of goodwill on both sides are going to have to now think of some other option, some other clever solution. And so your fellow titan of Israeli literature, Aleph Bet Yehoshua, A.B. Yehoshua, was in London earlier this year, and he said that he's trying to think now, the two-state solution may be beyond rescue, and he's trying to think of other ways. He doesn't know what they might be, but we can't just stay stuck. So where is your thinking? As I say, you were one of the very first to advocate this remedy. Where have you got to in your thinking about how this conflict, which was even haunting the characters in this novel all that time, all those years ago, where it might lead?
Right. This novel is this novel. I will give you my answer. Abravanel will give you a different answer, and Shmuel a different one, and Vald a different one, and Jesus Christ will definitely answer this question in a totally different way. So it's me speaking now.
Yeah.
Okay. First, 50 years is a very long time, but it's nothing in history. If I think of Ireland, next door to here, if I think of the religious wars inside this country, if I think of the bloody history of Europe, 50 years is nothing. Please bear with us. Us, I mean Israelis, Palestinians, Arabs. Look at your own European history, thousands of years of bloodshed and rivalry, to finally achieve a kind of relatively peaceful balance with or without Brexit. In the bottom line.
Yeah.
Bear with us. Now, there is a powerful brainwash machine right now coming, interestingly enough, from the Israeli far right, the West Bank settlers, the advocates of Greater Israel, and the radical left in Europe, including this country. And both those magnifiers are playing exactly the same music. The Israeli occupation is irrevocable. There is no going back on the occupation. The only solution is a one happy family, a one state solution. I think this is almost nonsense. Not almost, I think this is nonsense. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers on the West Bank are a problem, they are a serious problem, they are not irrevocable. I am old enough to remember 1 million French settlers leaving Algeria, very painful. Some of them were injured for life. I am old enough, we are all old enough to remember Sharon's own settlements, removed by force from the Gaza Strip 10 years ago, and no one was killed, not even badly injured in this traumatic. I'm not saying that it's going to be as easy on the West Bank, and by the way, I'm not even saying that every Jewish settler will have to leave the West Bank. If they want, some of them want to live in future state of Palestine, they should be allowed to leave there, not as masters. So I don't think it is irrevocable. I think we are speaking about a very small land, about the size of Wales. And it's the only homeland of the Israeli Jews and the only homeland of the Palestinian Arabs. We are not going anywhere, we don't have where to go. They are not going anywhere, they don't have where to go. Why can't we become one happy family and jump into a honeymoon bed together and start making love, not war? Because it's just unthinkable that after 100 years of violence, animosity, incitement, suddenly we can fall into each other's arms like in a lousy Hollywood movie and start loving one another in tears. It doesn't work like this. If anyone came forth with the idea here in Europe in 1945 that this is the time, 1945, for Germany and Poland to become one nation and start integrate, they will put him in a mental asylum. The Israelis and the Palestinians have to divide the small house into two smaller apartments. They have to start by saying nicely good morning to each other in the lift every morning. Then they can hop over to each other and have coffee together. Palestinian coffee will always be much better than Israeli coffee. Then possibly, eventually, they will start cooking their meals together, by which I mean shared economy, common market. Later on, Federation, Confederation, United States of the Middle East. After that, make love, not war. But I have been an evolutionist all my life. I know I have the reputation of a raving radical in the eyes of some people in my own country. I am not a radical. I believe in solutions. I resent salvations. You will find this in this novel. I resent all kinds of salvations. I believe in solutions. I'm an optimist. But I don't believe in being born again. I don't think individuals or nations can be born again.
And you mean for you, the one state idea is a salvationist idea. It's a straightening.
I tell you what it is. It's a kitsch. It's a kitsch. The idea that Israelis and Palestinians can forget everything that has been for the last 100 years and start integrating. I tell you where this kitsch comes from. It comes from the deep laziness of parts of the European left who think that they have the remedy for South Africa, and therefore everything is South Africa. You have a hammer, so every problem is a nail. Mm. Now, South Africa is a cholera, and Israel and Palestine is the plague. Both of them are very, very bad, but you don't use the same cure. It's irresponsible, because apartheid was about race, about discrimination, about white supremacy. Israel and Palestine is a little more complex than that. So you need a different remedy. You yes. need a different diagnosis, a different prescription, a different remedy.
You see, here, I'm guessing that in London, and you've been talking about your book in Paris and other places, you will find a very receptive audience to that message, and people will welcome it. The worry I would have, and perhaps others here might have, is are you getting heard when you say that in your own country? And this is a thought planted a little bit by the book. But in the book, you have a scene in there, it's 1960, you have a cafe, Atara, this wonderful European cafe, yes. The waiter comes over with a Viennese accent. And I couldn't help but think, you know, is Hamas part of an Israel that is fading and receding? And then now the hot-tempered Israel of today isn't listening to the kind of views you've just said about that we live in the shared house and we need to make two apartments. It makes such common sense outside. But in the fevered atmosphere of your own country, are you becoming more and more of a minority voice?
Well, it's back to square one. I told you it's impossible to get two Israelis to agree with one another. This has been the case 50 years ago, and this is still the case. Well, Israel is becoming hot-headed because of a lasting conflict. Winston Churchill said in his day that World War II was Britain's finest hour. Maybe it was. Long conflicts, if they last 100 years and more, they cannot be anyone's finest hour. They stink. They stink for the winners and for the losers. They stink for the occupiers and for the occupied. They stink. They are not anyone's finest hour. Yes, I think this solution is feasible, and it may materialize. Don't ask me when. I come from the land of the prophets. I won't risk being a prophet. Too much competition in the prophecy business in my country. But it can materialize. Best case scenario, the president of America, I hope it will be she, and the president of Egypt and the king of Saudi Arabia and the leader of the PLO coming in the morning to the Israeli Knesset, presenting a draft agreement to be ratified by the Knesset, no further claims. And the same afternoon, the same band goes 15 miles to Ramallah to get a ratification from the Palestinian National Assembly, I think people will convert overnight. Not everybody, not the fanatics, but the vast majority. As they converted when Sadat came to Jerusalem in 1978 and converted the Israelis overnight into returning the whole of Sinai to Egypt in return for peace. This is the best case scenario. Is it going to happen? I don't know. And to take your question a step further, I'll say it very simply. I love Israel very much, but I don't like it very much right now. I love it even though I don't like it. I love it because of the argumentativeness of Israel. I like it because every staircase in Israel is full of stories and memories and conflicting ideas. I love it because if I'm destined to collapse in the middle of the street, I'd rather collapse in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem and not here in London, with all due respect. There will be strangers who will put me back on my feet, and as soon as I'm back on my feet, there will be other strangers who will try to knock me down again. Fair enough. So I love it. I don't quite like it the way it is now.
What is it you don't like about it at the moment?
I don't like the aggression, and there is a lot of aggression. It may or may not be a result of 50 years of occupation, 100 years of solitude, if you wish, world hostility, public opinion hostility, justified or not justified or partly justified, but it's overwhelming hostility. It turns people into very aggressive beings.
You mean hostility towards each other?
Yes, yes, toward each other, toward the Palestinians, toward anyone who is different.
You talked about racism in today's Israel.
Of course. This is the plague of our time. There is racism in Israel just as there is racism here in London. No one is immune. And society is immersed in fierce conflict. They tend to become even more racist and fanatic and unforgiving and intolerant than societies not in a state of conflict. It was not great pleasure to be a German in London during World War II, even if you happen to be a Jewish German or a German Jew, it was not a big pleasure. It's not fun to be a Palestinian under Israeli occupation. Far from it, it's terrible. It's not even much fun to be a Palestinian citizen of Israel, voting freely. It's not fun. The answer is not revoke the hearts and the souls. The answer is terminate the conflict. I'll never say make love, not war. I will say make peace, not love.
What about some people, and then we'll open it up. Ari Shavit and other people have written that actually, even before you get to termination of the conflict, just ending the occupation actually is a goal in itself, not just as a means to the end of some peace agreement, but it's just causing so much pain for Palestinians and damage to Israel that should be almost the near-term goal, that instead of peace now, it should be end occupation now.
For selfish Israeli reasons, I'd say wonderful. Let's withdraw from the occupied territories and call it a day. In terms of Palestinian future, I'm not so sure. I'm not sure that in case of unilateral Israeli withdrawal without any agreement, the Palestinians are not going to experience Syria or Iraq on the West Bank. So as long as I believe that a reasonable treaty between Israel and Palestine is possible, I will prefer such a treaty to a unilateral Israeli withdrawal. If and when I'm convinced that this is not possible, I'll be in favor of unilateral withdrawal.
Yes, because otherwise you end up in a situation where you're saying, okay, we're going to continue occupying you for your sake.
No, this is not what I'm saying. I just want to know what is going to replace the Israeli occupation. If it is, let's say, an international mandate, international peacekeeping force, I'll do this tonight. I'll do it many years ago. I'll do it right at the outset. If it's going to be ISIS, I don't think it will be much fun for the Palestinians or for the Israelis, for that matter.
Yes. Much more to discuss, including delving back into the book. But why don't we open it up a bit and just take some questions. I'll take them in little groups if I can, so we get a chance to hear as many voices as possible. There's a mic. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And that was absolutely compelling. I just have a question. You've talked about the practicalities, and this is put on by The Guardian. Could I ask you a question about the media, the way this whole situation, which has gone on for so long, is perceived by the media and the social media worldwide? Thank you.
May I answer this right away?
Why don't you?
With your permission.
With my permission,
I think I can draw a clear line. between what I regard as a legitimate criticism of Israel, whether I accept it or not, and Jew-hating. The line to me is very simple. If you call Israel a villain, it's legitimate. If you call Israel the bad guy, I would partly agree with you. If you say Israel is the worst devil in the world, I think you are insane or obsessed, but I'll still say this is legitimate. But if you continue and say, and therefore there should be no Israel, that is crossing the line. That is anti-Semitism, because nobody said after Hitler's fall there should be no more Germany ever. Nobody said there should be no Russia after Stalin, or no Iraq after Saddam. If someone says, writes, claims that Israel is so vicious that it better ceases to exist, this is crossing the line between legitimate criticism, fierce criticism, and anti-Semitism.
On that, I mean, there you have a character in your book who nobody would want to call an anti-Semite, Abravanel, who was against there being a Jewish state, who didn't want a Jewish state to exist, but he, you wouldn't want to call him an anti-Semite.
Well, Abravanel was there before there was a Jewish state. It's a totally different thing to say that we better not have another child, we have enough children, or to claim that this particular child has to be killed. It's a totally different moral venue. There is no comparison.
And what about, and people here will understand why I'm pushing this, because it was a live debate in this country just a few months ago. What about people who say, okay, it's there now, we're not going to kill this child, but it shouldn't have been created, that its creation was a mistake? Does that count as anti-Semitism to you?
Well, yes, it does to me, but this is harmless, because this is people lamenting about the fact that the Crusades in the Middle Ages should not have taken place, or the conversion of the Jews should have taken place, or Hitler should have never come to power. We know that, we agree, we disagree. It's a waste of time to argue now about the road not taken. This is the business of novelists. My business in life is the road not taken. My stories are about the road not taken, very often, not just politically, personally, emotionally, sexually, the road not taken. But in terms of political thinking, of current affair thinking, I regard this as a waste of time.
But you're not just saying that when, say, a hypothetical former mayor of London said that it was a mistake that Israel was created, you're not just saying it's a waste of time. For you, that crosses the line into anti-Semitism.
Well, it's pretty close to the line, because this is more or less like saying that America should then never become independent, it should have remained a British colony. You can say that, but I would find it very funny.
Yeah, funny is maybe different. Yeah. Who's somebody up here? Yes. Yeah.
You talk about the fevered atmosphere in Israel at the moment and aggression. I read recently, I think it was in the Jerusalem Post, that an ex-Shin Bet or Mossad head said that the real threat to Israel now is not external, it's internal. Does it mean by that civil disturbance or civil war?
Can you please repeat the question for me?
The questioner quotes a former head of the Shin Bet who was asked, and actually this has been echoed by other former military leaders, you know, what is the big threat? And he said it wasn't external, meaning Iran or the Palestinians, it was internal, which was understood as being the threat of civil war. And I think the questioner asked about civil disturbances, but whether you think do you see the big existential threat, if you see one, to Israel is from outside or from within?
This is not an either-or question. Israel is facing a serious external threat from radical fanatic Islam, not from the Palestinians. They are not strong enough to be a real threat to the future of Israel. But radical fanatic Islam is a serious external threat. At the same time, we have internal threats. Fanaticism, bigotry, fundamentalism. Those threats, by the way, we share with many other European countries, including this blessed England.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Thank you. Let's see who else would like to ask a question. I think lady there.
A very simple clarification, because I don't know if I've understood. You talked about the difference between aggression and violence. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that?
Okay, and let's hear from you over here. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk. One thing, when we look at Israel from the outside, The biggest thing that come out is the passion of the settlers. We don't see any other passion in politics as we have seen from the settlers for the last 20-odd years.
Okay, so take that one first. What's noticed from the outside is that the people with the passion and the energy and commitment does seem to be among the settlers, whereas perhaps people from the kind of Israel that you were steeped in, the kibbutz movement and others, seem to be less committed or less driven than those people.
Well, you know, being passionate is very important in life, but it's not always a blessing. I've seen very passionate people doing terrible things throughout history, in my country and elsewhere. Mm. Yes, many of the settlers are passionate. Not all of them are evil, by the way. Not every West Bank settler is a murderous Arab hater. Some are, some are not. But the point is that my kind of Israelis have objected the very idea of building any settlements at all in the occupied territories right after the 67 war, right after the spectacular and justified Israeli military in 67, my colleagues and I objected the idea of building settlements. We have failed to convince the rest of the Israelis in this. The settlers are there. Passionate, yes, they are. They were passionate in Gaza too. They were passionate in Algiers, in De Gaulle's Algiers too. Mm. What will be, I don't know. What will become of their passion? Will their passion overcome common sense, pragmatism, a sense of reality or not? I cannot tell you. I cannot give you any guarantees. If you want me this evening to draw a happy ending to the Middle Eastern tragedy, I'm sorry, I cannot do this. I cannot even invent a happy ending for my own novels. I cannot do that. But what I'm saying, in the novel and outside the novel, I say things are open-ended. The radicals, as I said earlier, the radicals on the far right in Israel and the far left here, they try to tell us that things are irrevocable. My basic conviction is that people do change. This novel is about how three people change one another in the course of one winter. I do that all my life. I watch people changing. Listen, I don't know every one of you personally. I don't even know Jonathan that well. But ask yourselves, is there anyone here in the auditorium who never ever surprised herself or himself, asking herself, is it really me? Am I doing what I'm doing? People are capable of surprising themselves. This table will never surprise you unless it catches fire. You people, me, Jonathan, every one of us is capable of surprising themselves or others. People do change. History is filled with people who changed their minds and hearts in a small way, not being born again. This is my political credo, and this is also my business as a novelist. If you wish, this novel, every one of my novel, is about a relatively non-dramatic changes which do occur in the hearts and minds of people. You want me to know if and when this will happen in the Middle East? I'm sorry, I don't know. But it's possible. I believe this is open-minded. Passionate, yes, the settlers are passionate. I'm also passionate in a different way. You sound passionate. Whose passion will overcome, I don't know. We have to wait and see.
Your point about change, I just want to interject this, is interesting because this theme in the novel about treachery and betrayal and treason, often it's because someone changes.
Yeah.
And it's the people around who have not changed, accuse the person who's changed of betraying them somehow.
Good. My protagonist, Shmuel Ash, says that very often a traitor is he or she who changes in the eyes of those who despise change and fear change and don't believe in change. Well, if you look back at the list of people throughout history who were labeled traitors by some of their own contemporaries, by some of their own people, you will find that this is a very wonderful club to be in. It's an honor to be in this club of traitors. The prophet Jeremiah, or Abraham Lincoln, who liberated the slaves in America and was accused of treason by millions of Americans, was assassinated. Charles de Gaulle in Algiers. Mikhail Gorbachev. The courageous German officers who tried to kill Hitler, they were executed for treason. David Ben-Gurion, the founding father of Israel, when he accepted in 47 the painful United Nations resolution of slicing the Jewish historical homeland into two and creating Palestine next door to Israel, he was accused of treason. So was Menachem Begin when he gave the whole of Sinai in return for peace. So was Sadat, who came to Jerusalem to make peace and paid with his life. So were Rabin and Peres when they signed the Oslo Accords, and Rabin paid with his life. Listen, Thomas Mann, Pasternak, Solzhenitsyn, Albert Camus, to be in the club of traitors is a great honor sometimes. It's a very distinguished club. When they call me a traitor, I wear the title here on my lapel as a decoration.
And the common thread is these are all people who were prepared to change.
Yes. Not everyone who is prepared to change is my hero. Some people are changing for the worse. Not everyone is changing for the better. It's not the change itself. It's the courage to be ahead of your time in a way which proves to be a blessing.
The lady there asked about the difference between aggression and violence, because you said that for the peaceniks, or the pacifists rather, on the left, particularly in Europe, the worst thing they could imagine was violence, and you said, no, the worst thing I can imagine is aggression, and sometimes the only response to that aggression is violence. Can you distinguish for the questioner these two ideas?
I said this 10 minutes ago, and I still agree with myself. It doesn't always happen to me. Well, look, violence is a result of aggression. Always, aggression is the motivation for violence. Sometimes aggression becomes verbal violence, abuse, hateful language, insult, oppression, a humiliation of the other. But very often aggression takes violent forms. And if we are to act like thoughtful family doctors, we have to be precise with our diagnosis before we write the prescription. And the diagnosis is that the most dangerous quality in the human psyche is aggression. And aggression, like fanaticism and often combined with fanaticism, is a bad gene which exists. Whether Jesus Christ approved that it exists or not, it exists in most people. We better be aware of this. We better realize that the name of the malaise is aggression. Violence is just a consequence.
I mean, just to help us understand that, can you think of an example of aggression that did not come with violence, just so we can distinguish these two ideas?
You know, people call other people terrible names in the tube here. They mistreat other people because of their color, gender, belief, faith, the way they dress or the way they undress. It happens all the time. These are non-violent forms of aggression, which often lead to aggression. Often they don't lead to aggression, but they are bad nonetheless.
Thank you. I think somebody here has been waiting patiently, but let's see other hands if they're going up. Yeah, lady there is going to keep you. Keep your hand up so we can get a microphone to you. Yeah, you go there.
Shalom, Amos.
Shalom.
If I may, I'd like to take you away from Judas and this particular book, and I'm pretty sure that it will be translated to dozens of languages. The thing it is, it is the thing that fascinates me, how Benava Lechoshek, between love and darkness, has been translated to dozens, I believe, over 50 languages. How such a provincial I could call it provincial in inverted commas, book, being translated. People in China read, I'm an Israeli Tel Aviv girl. How people in China, they don't, sometimes don't even know Israel, how do they relate to this book that describe only three roads and the journey between your parents' house to your uncle's pharmacy? How does this happen?
Fascinating, thank you. I was going to bring up the tale of love and darkness, but you've got there. Let's hear from the person who's waiting there, and then we'll turn around. Yeah.
I just would like to go back to a life in writing and know a bit about your writing routine and what you're like in the middle of a book, and how does your day go?
Good. Well, a nice range of questions there. Let's start with the last one about your writing routine. You always used to write standing up and with a pen, but tell us what you're doing now.
I still write with a pen. I don't stand up that much because my back is not wonderful, but I still write with a pen. Not that it matters. I do it for central reasons. I prefer the pen to the computer. I'm a very early riser. So I rise before 4 every morning.
Before 4?
Before 4.
My word.
Summer and winter. This is not new. I've been doing this all my life. And
was that the kibbutz that did that, working in the
kibbutz, I had to milk cows or drive a tractor. Everybody had to rise up before 5 in the kibbutz. Not a big deal. But even now, I'm an early riser. I take a walk in the dark. There is nothing like a walk in the dark to clear your head and knock everything into proportion. When I take my morning walk, and I sometimes think about last night's news, when this or that politician used words such as never, forever, or for the rest of eternity, I know that the rocks in the desert are laughing at him or the stars in the sky. So it helps me knock things into proportion. Then I make myself a cup of coffee, and before 5 o'clock I sit by my desk. No telephones, the whole world is asleep anyway. And I work these days for 4 hours, a little more, a little less. Then I call it a day, and in the afternoon I go back to my study to destroy what I've written in the morning.
That's a good routine. I like that. So I don't think I can emulate this routine at all. But I'm interested about where you live, though, because for many years you lived on the kibbutz Fulda, and then in Arad. And in both those situations, I can imagine the 4 o'clock in the morning walk is with this biblical landscape of rocks and mountains. But now you live in Tel Aviv. What is your 4 a.m. walk like there?
The beach is 20 minutes moderate walk from where I live. There is a beautiful park 7 minutes from where I live and another park 15 minutes from where I live. Besides, even the streets become a fascinating park early in the morning. When I'm lucky, I get to say good morning to the newspaper deliverer. Sometimes, not always. The whole neighborhood is dark. Sometimes I see a single light in a window and I invent a story. Why the light is on at 4 o'clock in the morning? Sometimes the light is just a bathroom light left to scare away death or illness. That's also a story. Sometimes all the windows are darkness, and even this is a story. So 4 o'clock in the morning is an interesting hour. I recommend it to those of you who have the guts to wake up early. You will find that your own neighborhood is a different planet at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And so you write until about 9 or so, and then you come back to it in the afternoon.
Yes.
The other question was about Tale of Love and Darkness, which is this non-fiction memoir, which obviously has found a global audience and is now a film made by Natalie Portman. Mm-hmm. You've seen the film. I know you're not going to talk about it much, but just tell us something of, answer the questioner's inquiry as to why you think this book has become almost universal and traveled to all these places in the world, even though it discusses a very particular place at a particular time. And perhaps just tell us something of the experience of seeing your life on this screen.
I'm sorry, 2 corrections before I answer the question. I don't like the English word fiction, and I'm not very fond of the word memoir for A Tale of Love and Darkness. By the way, for the same reason. The Hebrew title is Sipur, and the English one is A Tale. A tale is older than memoir and older than novel and older than short story and older than history. It's the oldest literary form in the world. People were telling each other tales even in the Neanderthal caves at night. Now, a tale is everything. It contains memory and invention and fantasy and wishful thinking and fears and dreads and, yes, recollections and facts. So the English word fiction implies lie, and I'm not a liar. And memoir is limiting it. Mm. It's a tale. I think a tale is, in brackets, a tale is as ancient as human sexuality itself. I believe that the line between animal sexuality and human sexuality is that human sexuality always involves a tale, whether we actually tell it or not, but it involves a tale. So it's a very old form. Why call a tale of love and darkness memoir or fiction or non-fiction? It is a tale. Why is it extensively read in China or in Brazil or in Korea? You have to ask the readers. All I can tell you is that I am an enthusiastic readers of writers who wrote about places where I have never been and cultures which I hardly know. No one can visit Chekhov's 19th century little town of M, full stop, or N, full stop, because they don't exist anymore. And yet I read Chekhov and he transports me to those towns. I know them, I know the gossip, I know the politics, I know the family secrets. I know the people's dreams and fantasies when I read Chekhov. So maybe I'm not Chekhov, I wish I were in his league, I'm not even in his league, but I think people read books precisely for this, because on the one hand, they are eager to find that all our secrets are the same. On the other hand, they are equally eager to find that not all our secrets are the same. And good literature offers you both. All our secrets are the same, and yes, some of our secrets are not the same. But this is a question to the Chinese readers, not to me.
So a question about your books. You have an amazing sensitivity of use of language in English, from what we can hear this evening. How far do you get involved in the language that your translator uses?
And my question was related to that. What are we missing when we read an Amos Oz novel in English? What's there in the texture of the Hebrew that an English reader, even with a wonderful translation like his, is not getting?
If you promise to take the following with a grain of salt, I would say that my novels are translated into English by Nicholas Delange with interruptions from the author. My English is more or less sufficient to sometimes suggest that a certain nuance should be possibly rephrased or an alternative be considered, not beyond that. Fortunately, I don't have to do that with other translators. My books are translated into more than 40 languages. This one is in 12 or 13 languages and 17 more are in the pipeline. Thank God I don't have to read all those translations and judge them. But I do think that translation is one of the most underestimated fine arts in the world. Translating a work of literature is like playing a violin concerto on the piano. It can be done, and it can be done very successfully, provided you never try to force the piano to produce the sounds of the violin. Remember, it's a different musical instrument, which is why I say not only to Nicholas Delange, to each and every one of my translators, including people who translate me into languages I shall never be able to read, I say to them, please be unfaithful in order to be loyal. I never said this to my wife, but I do say this to all my translators. Now, Nicholas Delange is first and foremost a language musician. Translating a work of literature is not transferring an idea from one country to another. It's not transplanting a concept from one language to another, or a word, not even finding the equivalent idiom, which is more sophisticated. The equivalent idiom in a foreign language, no. It's trying to produce a similar melody on a totally different musical instrument. And believe me, we have no time to give you a crash course in Hebrew, much as I'd love to do that tonight. Believe me that translating Hebrew into English or any European language is traveling a very, very long way. By comparison, I believe German into English or English into French is almost in the family. And Nicholas Delange is a master of producing, and I can judge because as a passive knowledge of English, I can judge. He is a master of making the melody travel from one language to another. And I take my hat off to him and to my other translators. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Judas is translated into English by Nicholas Delange and is published by Chatto & Windus. Many thanks to Amos Oz and to Jonathan Friedland. We have lots more Guardian Live events coming up this autumn, including evenings with the novelists Emma McBride and Jonathan Safran Foer, and a whole children's festival in London in October. You can find them by searching for Guardian Events. Next week on this podcast, we look down the barrel of infinity with cosmologist Sean Carroll and Adam Biles, whose first darkly comic novel takes us headfirst, if not perhaps feet first, into life in a care home for the elderly. If you enjoy the Books podcast, you might want to take a look at our award-winning long-form journalism strand, The Long Reads. This week in the Audio Long Reads podcast, Guardian journalist John Harris asks, does the left have a future? The audio version of this long read can be found by checking out theguardian.com/podcasts. And as always, for more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search for Guardian Books podcast. You can find us on the Guardian website, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or on your smartphone. Just look for your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.